Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, it's June 9th, 2023. Good evening and welcome. I'm your moderator, Leroy McKnight, with Jenny Evans, Vice President of UAW Local 651. In this podcast, we will strive to present a fair, factual, and true representation of the facts, mixed in with some well-experienced opinion and a bit of humor. Let's see if we can find that Vice President Jenny Evans. I should say the Vice President Jenny Evans. And we'll bring her on here.
Hi.
Hello, Vice President. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
No, not so bad tonight. It's about right at 9 o'clock here in the evening on a Friday, again, June 9th. So we're here to talk a little bit about what's going on and some of the things we have to put some background in so that everybody sort of understands it. We're going to try and keep it as brief as we can. So our first section, and this is for the offices and duties and fact-finding. And these are the offices that you've held or send to while holding. And please, everybody, remember to come to Sunday's union meeting at Local 651. I believe it's 11 a.m. It'll last a couple of hours. And I think there's going to be food somewhere. So we'll talk about that a little later. That's kind of a teaser. What offices have you held? Vice President Jenny Evans.
I have held trustee and guide and now vice president.
Okay. And your current office is vice president?
Yes.
Okay. What are the duties of, the UAW constitutional duties of vice president?
Well, you have a lot of duties, within checks and balances and things like that, and to uphold the Constitution and enforce the Constitution.
Okay. The notion that everybody takes an initiation oath and then officers take an installation oath, is that correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Can you tell me about those, and then these are the things that you I think this is the initiation ceremony, without going into too much of it. This says that you pledge to faithfully observe the Constitution and laws of this union and the Constitution of the United States and comply with all the rules and regulations government thereof, not to divulge or make known any private proceedings of this union, faithfully perform all the duties assigned to you at the best of your ability and skill, and to so conduct yourself at all times as to not to bring reproach upon my union, and bear true and faithful allegiance to the International UAW. That's something that everybody takes, right? No, this is something, this is initiation into the union. Okay. This is something, even though you may not take it, it's something that's in the Constitution and you're obliged to abide by. I think they sign this, they might not go to meeting to get it, but they sign this document. Probably at sign or when they hire in either management or the union that's present to assure that. I know management had me sign it when I long time ago hired in. And that was required because it's a closed shop. The other one is the installation. Article, and that I think it's article. You have that available?
Yeah. Yep, it's Article 39.
The installation ceremony.
Okay, yeah.
All right. That was the initiation. That's Article 43
mm-hmm.
that I just mm-hmm. read. I'd like you to get into, I think it's 39. Pretty sure if you don't have it right there, I'll just go ahead and read it when I find it here. 38 and it's 39. Yeah, there it is. Installation officer says, give attention while I read you the obligation. Do you hereby pledge on your honor to perform the duties of your respective offices? That's a very important part there, of your respective office, as required by the Constitution of this Union. In other words, you're supposed to stay in your own lane here, okay? You're not supposed to do other people's jobs. That's going on around the nation, by the way. Others are getting into other people's lane regarding duties. Not a good thing. We need to stay in our own lane. To bear true and faithful allegiance to the International Union, UAW, and to the best of your ability and with complete and good faith support, advance and carry out the official policies of the International Union and this local union. To deliver all books, papers, and other property of the union that may be in your possession at the end of your term for a successor in the office, in your successor in office, and at all times conduct yourself as becomes a member of this union. They respond, I do. And then the duties by the installing officer are outlined, and they are defined in the International Constitution. Should emergency arise, you're expected to act accordingly to the dictates of common sense, guided by an earnest desire to advance the best interest of the International Union and this local union. That would mean not to divide it. Get it together and keep it dancing, right? And I trust you will all faithfully perform your duties so that you may gain not only the esteem of your siblings, but also what is of even more importance, the approval of your conscience. You will now assume your respective stations. And then the duties are outlined in 40. Article 40, and we'll get into those in just a bit. So that's the constitutional oaths, and we may cover those a little later for just the idea that we want to remind them, because this is sort of important, that everybody advance the union and not divide it, and that's just not a good thing. Let's take a look at are you there at Article 40, Section 2, the duties of the Vice President?
Yep.
That are actually written here. Can you read those and just read them? I know you had a lot of other duties as Vice President, but these are the ones in the Constitution. Would you read those, please?
Yep. Article 40, Section 1 says, President, it shall be the duty of the President to preside at the meetings of all local unions, sign all orders on the treasury authorized by the local union, countersign all checks issued by the financial secretary against accounts of the local union when ordered by the union, enforce all provisions of the Constitution, and appoint committees not otherwise provided for. They shall be a member ex officio of all committees.
Okay, so a couple things there. Enforce the provisions of the Constitution. I happen to know that that's exclusive to the duties of the president. There are no other officers that have to enforce the provisions, that have the authority to enforce the provisions of the Constitution. Oftentimes it's referred to as the hall responsibility versus the plant responsibility. However, enforcement of the provisions of this Constitution of the UAW do bleed over into the work facility, and it is not the party's responsibility for the negotiations and grievances to be doing the president's duties of enforcing the Constitution. No other party may do so. The vice president, why don't you just, are you looking at the highlighted page there? Why don't you just read that part?
Yep.
Vice
President, Section 2, Article 40, Vice President or Vice President shall assist the President in the discharge of their duties and shall attend all sessions of the local union. In the case of the absence or incapacity of the President's duties shall be performed by the Vice President, provided that there are two or more Vice Presidents. The local union shall determine which of them shall perform such duties.
Right, that would be in their local bylaws if they add a second vice president. It's interesting here that you would do the vice president, in your case, it's you, would perform the duties of the president. And there are no limitations here of the duties. It's all the duties while you're functioning as president. The other thing in Section 1, and we'll need this a little later, in the back of the Constitution, there are a couple of things back there. First is the ethics code, and I see in the latest Constitution that they've put numbers next to the paragraphs. I've written some appeals where I had to just reference, the second paragraph down, and now they've actually numbered them, which is makes it much, much better for referring to each paragraph. The other thing it says here in the duties, it says the president shall be a member ex officio of all committees. And in the back of the book where there are the ethical practices code, there's also an interpretation section. And in the interpretation section for Article 40, Section 1 of the president, there's four interpretations, the last of which, most important in this issue tonight, is that the president does not set ex officio on either the election committee or the trial committees. So the president does not have authority to be present at any of those meetings, only they're allowed to communicate in order to set elections based on what days are good for the local, and then the president and the chair of the election committee come to agreement, then they set the election. The president, they work on when a good trial selection committee meeting would be together. And then they put and then the president's done with that. Then they put a notice out. The president conducts the trial committee selection, but after that may not be part of any committee functions on the trial committee. So, all right, you're clear on that, right? May not be present or anything else at a trial, not allowed. The president is not ex officio on that committee, so he can't participate or vote. Do you know the definition of enforce? I mean, you're supposed to enforce the Constitution. What does that mean?
Okay, so to enforce, you're gonna.
Right. Are you following?
You're
gonna
do the process of ensuring compliances with the laws and regulations and the rules, the standards, and of normals.
Social norms, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that again, repeat that for us, so that everybody understands. Go slow enough so that they really catch on. What enforce the Constitution by definition? What enforce means?
So if you're going to enforce something, you're going to enforce the process of ensuring compliances with whatever laws or regulations, the rules, the standards, and in this case, it's the Constitution.
And social norms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Social norms, meaning that, you know, you're publicly not running around naked, right? That's not a social norm. You're publicly not running around hitting somebody in the face with a beer bottle because your song didn't play before his, right? That's not a social norm, is it?
Right, no, obviously not. It's not. You're going to get in trouble.
and fights are not a social norm. Normally, I mean, if you're going to a fight, you know, a boxing match or, you know, wrestling or whatever, then that's quite different, right? So, okay. Mm-hmm. Do you know what the public review board is?
Yes.
Would you explain that to the listeners?
Well, the public review board is pretty much, in a sense, who almost governs the international union when you have an appeal. It's an outside resource almost, in a sense.
Right. It's kind of like if you go to, you know, here in the United States, we have what's called statutory law that you can go and look it up, but there's also case laws by judges and courts that affect nearly every paragraph of statutory law. You know, let's say that they have a eavesdropping law. You know, there might be some statutory law that's eavesdropping, and then they have case law that perfects it. And the PRB, Public Review Board, is the highest appellate authority, as you indicated. Also, they will make what's called PRB decisions in different cases, otherwise in real world called case law. Are there any PRB cases that affect the office of president? Do you know?
Absolutely, because we refer back to them.
Right. Do you have those and what they are?
What is the
PRB rulings that affect the office of president?
And what does that say?
Okay.
Okay, it says, one thing that I've got noted about that specific case is it says the appropriate route for, an official to gather such payroll and attendance information is to go to a member of the bargaining committee or the local union president.
So the proper authority to get time and attendance resides only at this time, only with the bargaining chair and the president. Is that what you're saying?
That's what the public review board has deemed, yes. That's the proper method.
And what's that number? PRB 1586, right?
Yep.
Okay, good. Are there any other PRB decisions that affect the office of president that you know of?
Think of anything off the top of my head. I know that there have been several cases, but
yeah, we have a number of cases that we're going to go through here this evening. I don't think there's anything more that's relevant here in your instance. So let's you have the duties of the executive board, and in that it has some fact finding. You want to cover that for the listeners?
Yep. Okay, so Article 40 under the UAW Constitution lists the president's and the vice president's duties, but you've also got other roles and responsibilities of a guideline, in the guidebooks.
Right. For the local union executive board, right?
Yep, and it lists your responsibilities. For, let's say, you know, example, president, it tells you your responsibilities to make sure that the local union officers and the committees know and carry out their duties as outlined in the UAW Constitution and your local bylaws.
Mm-hmm. And what about fact finding?
Well, in the same book, which is, you know, the handbook for local union elected officers, it's got a chart, if you will, of, you know, the president, the vice president, recording secretary, et cetera. Fact finding is listed in there along with a list of responsibilities.
Okay. And so the responsibility of the president is in part to fact find if the president's enforcing the Constitution, and enforcing means to ensure compliance with laws, regulations, rules, standards, and social norms. You can't be running around naked in a plant. So as you do that, occasionally you have to start an investigation. And that is proper to start an investigation. And I can tell you, I've done a fair amount of research and talked to a lot of well-experienced union leaders, active and retired, and you find out the who, what, where, why, and how before you go in. In other words, you always know the answer before you ask the question. Did you do X? Okay, you already know the answer because you've done your homework. Unlike what, in this case, the charging parties, you know, the ones that, you know, had bad behavior, would definitely like you to go straight to them so they can, you know, debunk anything that might be that they might have done. They either say, oh, that didn't happen that way, or this or that. So so in fact finding, there's a number of things that you do really before you go and approach. One, would you say one of those are to investigate the scene if there was an incident in another facility? You see, bringing reproach upon the union is not limited to the four walls of the work facility. When you're out and you're known to be a union officer, you can't run around with delusional self-entitlement thinking you can bring alcohol into a bar repeatedly and ask to leave, and then others start getting mad at you when you don't.
Mm-hmm.
With your, you know, the stuff you bring in. And we don't know exactly, but the idea is you know that before you go approach the people, because I happen to know that people never reference what started the incident in question.
Mm-hmm.
And you wonder how that occurred. And your investigation was preempted before being complete. And the we'll get into the ethical practices regarding investigations a little bit later, because we'll go through the ethical practice requirements. In this instance, did you start an investigation? And I mean, let's just talk about, you know, how this came to your attention, this incident of bad behavior that apparently brought a lot of reproach to the union. And we don't need any more of that, do we? Because we just had a bunch of officers go to prison, as I recall. high-level officers. And it's probably not done yet. They're still investigating, as I'm told. So how did this so we kind of covered the need for the fact finding, okay? Mm-hmm. And let's just talk about, you know, fact finding would be to get the 911 call log. Did you do that? Did you get the 911 call log?
I did.
Yeah, and how many 911 calls?
37 calls.
37 calls.
37 calls were placed in 911.
Yeah, and then did you go and ask the party that was in charge? You see, the bartender's in charge of the any facility where they sell. It's called the dram shop laws. And they changed some time ago, but the bartender has more authority than the owner when they're working. Did you contact that bartender and get any information regarding
this
reproach upon our union?
I did. I was able to obtain what time or approximate times that the parties entered the bar or what time her shift started. And so we had an estimated time that we knew we were looking at.
Okay, and based on, okay. Did you order the 911 before or after speaking with the proprietor, there, the manager, bartender?
After.
After you spoke with the bartender that was in charge during that shift. Okay.
Yeah, because I had no idea that the police were actually called and, you know, assisted in the situation. So the video that I had seen, you know, it didn't show that. It just showed a portion of the event.
Right. Yeah, I think the video was just the last 90 seconds or so of what was going on, maybe 2 minutes. So there was obviously quite a bit more. And the idea that there's only 10 people in the bar was as represented, didn't seem to be lining up with what others said. And of course, evasiveness is one of the things you look for in fact finding. Listen for contradictions that can't be explained. It's part of the things that you look for in fact finding. There's a list of them, and we have that list available right now before us. And then did you advance this investigation that you found there to be a lot of, did a lot of members contact you prompting your investigation beyond beyond what the Constitution requires you? And about how many?
Yeah.
Do you think? Quite a few?
Oh, yeah. There were, you know, the video went viral on Facebook and was shared on our member group page, and it caused somewhat of a disturbance, you know, to put it lightly. So they were commenting all types of stuff. I was being tagged and stuff, you know, inbox calls, you name it, for probably 2 days straight.
All right. And this incident happened, I think, on July 10, carried over into July, a few minutes into July 11th. Of 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you, at that time, when you were doing your fact-finding, before you ever approached anybody regarding, you know, their behavior and you know, I mean, this wasn't intended. Did you intend to do any real damage? I mean, the ethics just say, you know, let's fix this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Get a little correction of the behavior and, you know, and then, you know, let the members know that this has been addressed and, you know, doesn't,
mm-hmm.
they don't need to know. A lot of stuff, they just flatten it. You know, I mean, I can tell you, you know, from my leadership times some time ago, I still know things that I won't repeat, you know, because
mm-hmm.
it's just none of anybody's business. I mean, I would never, mm-hmm. ever, because I've been involved in some of the EAP work, when we, mm-hmm. you know, try to encourage somebody to be, go to, you know, AA or something, take the 30-day, you know, dry out.
There has to be a level of confidentiality. But since this went viral and it was, you know, the video went viral, I had no choice.
Right.
The members knew. There was no keeping anything quiet. And they wanted answers.
Yeah. So in your, did everybody know that you, you know, ordered the 911 or was that pretty quiet?
No. Nobody knew.
Yeah, and that you went over there and talked to the bartender, maybe a couple people sitting in the bar if they were there, and you walk in and you casually walk over and say, hi, you know, what's going on? And, you know, you talk in a private way. So nobody really knew what the conversation was. You had a private conversation. So you're just building, you know, who, what, where, when, why, and how, right? So before you go, and it's like anything else. You know, when you're building a case on a grievance, for example, that's what you do. Right? You don't go tell management, this is what I'm doing. You don't tell them until you get ready, right? So and we'll get into that a little further down. We don't want to be too long here, folks. The next thing that you did, we're going to have a little bit of a section change here in just a second. But one of the things you did was contact management for time and attendance. Just to assure, and that's allowable by you for time and attendance in the PRV 1586, right? That you or the chairman can do that, correct? Okay, all right. Mm-hmm. So you did that. Now we're at minute 33 into the show. It's almost 34 into the show. We're going to change sections now. So if you just want to go back and just take a break, go to work, you know, do something, go to whatever you need to do, and come back, you'd come back in at minute 34-ish, and this we're going to hit section two here. So we're going to give you an idea that you can listen to this in segments if you want. As we go into section two, we remind everybody, please come to the meeting. You tell them, Jennifer. I don't want to be talking here.
So there is a union meeting this Sunday at 11 o'clock, and we are asking all members to show up. Well, I am asking all members to show up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our next section here is the timeline of the email and text communication. This is very interesting. I tell you, when I was presented with this, it's actually pretty scary that union leaders would do this to divide the membership for the only purpose, political, and to divide the membership.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of management's goals, would you agree that one of management's goals are
divide the membership?
Divide the membership, right. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you want? There's a timeline here. Do you want to kind of just go down those, and I'll interject when the important parts kick in. How's that? Just tell them, you know, to start with July 10 and how this came to your attention as the timeline progresses. It's the bottom page two.
Okay, so on July 10th, there was a fight that occurred approximately 11 p.m. On July 11th at 7:38 was when I got my first, you know, text. Saying that there was a fight that went social or viral from a member.
I mean, not from a member, because confidentiality matters here, so you're not going to just out anybody. So that's when
from
they started coming in. The next morning at 7:38, they started coming in. Because were you functioning as president at the time?
I was.
Okay. So you were functioning as president. Okay. and people were contacting you as president, do something. Okay, so,
mm-hmm.
and they started the next morning, 7:38 a.m. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What else? Okay.
So by then, the fight had already gone viral. They were posting it on social media, sharing it to our group page. The membership was, you know, in a half uproar. And the later that it got on the day, the worse it got. You know, then members were seeing the fight and, you know, the comments, here they come. The same day, around 8:30 in the morning, I consulted with the financial secretary. Now, mind you, I did have a witness with me. I just, you know, I was working at the hall. We were doing some landscaping. So my witness was there. He's seen, you know, the interaction. I was told to look into it, and I won't say all of what was said, but we'll leave it at that. But I was told to look into the time and attendance. So around 9:30, I go back out. I'm working on the landscaping.
Was that by another officer, top four officer?
Yes, the financial secretary.
Oh, okay. All right. That's top four officers, president, vice president, financial secretary,
mm-hmm.
recording secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So around 9:30, one of the parties asked me to remove the video. I agreed to do so. I followed that up with a statement saying I'm not going to allow the video to, you know, be reposted. I tried to defend them.
You made that statement on Facebook. Is that what you're saying on your group
yes,
page?
Yes, on the same group okay. page that it was being shared on, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I tried to defend them, and I told them, the members, I'm not going to allow it. You know, let's not tear each other down, bring disarray on the local. So
right.
the next day, which was July 12th, at 8:20 a.m., after a day and a half, the members were still complaining. They were still wanting answers. So at 8:23, I emailed labor and asked only for time and attendance and explained that there was an incident.
Okay.
The same day,
within
a few minutes, he responded.
Okay. You
within
did
a few
this.
Minutes, he responded.
Mm-hmm. As you
okay.
did this request, there's a section of federal law, Title 29, U.S. Code, Section 157, often referred to as Section 7, that
mm-hmm.
gives you protected and concerted
activities
mm-hmm. in the interest of the membership.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
allowing the right to
important.
Conduct union business.
Right. Allowing you
mm-hmm.
to conduct union business. And the ethics code echoes that same language, by the way, that you may do that without interference from anyone
mm-hmm.
as you conduct that, your investigation in the interest of the membership as a protected and concerted activity. Also, while we're on it, management may not interfere in the running
mm-hmm.
of the union. It's called
mm-hmm.
the administration of the union. That is an unfair labor practice.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that
mm-hmm.
that's very, very bad. Very bad that management would do that. So, go ahead and continue. You said 8:31 or 8:23. Okay.
8:23 is when I asked for time and attendance. I didn't offer any information. I said there was an incident. Can you, confirm that these members were not on the clock?
Mm-hmm.
That was the only information I offered. He responded with that he didn't feel comfortable providing that information. Without understanding why it was being requested. So essentially, he was
right.
violating, you know, my
right.
rights.
He was setting up a coercion question to coerce,
mm-hmm.
coerce information out of you, okay? Because he's supposed to provide that without question, right? Time and attendance. You're doing an investigation, and it has to do with the union, and he is trying to coerce out of you what you are doing, you know, and it's none of his business, right? Flat, none of his business. What was his next? That was the first sentence of his two-sentence paragraph. What was the next thing he said?
He just responded, Jennifer, I don't feel comfortable providing you with this information you requested without understanding why it's being requested. Please provide more detail in regards to why you say incident.
Okay. That sentence, the second one, does it have a question mark at the end of it?
Yep.
That's an interrogation question, right? Okay. We're going to talk about interrogation questions or freely volunteering information to management. This interrogation question right here has been ignored by the local union, the International Executive Board in their consideration, and so far the Public Review Board. This question right here has been ignored. It's currently under request for reconsideration, the last appeal step. So as he asked, he's interfering with the administration of the union. Did you ask that question as the vice president, or how did you make your request for time and attendance under what authority?
As functioning president.
You said it as functioning president, okay. Or or even acting president, to be totally transparent. But you were the functioning president, and he knew that that request was coming from the functioning president. And believe me, he knows about PRB 1586. It gives you authority to ask him for time and attendance without question. The second he questions it's interfering with union business and unfair labor act. That's also protected under 157 because you were doing protected and concerted activity. Pardon me. So having said that, we need to really make sure that everybody understands that was an interrogation question, and it is the crux of this entire disaster that's happened that has divided the membership in this local unit, horribly divided. Okay, so the next thing that happened, what had happened there, because that was at 8:31 a.m. on the 12th, right? So go ahead and continue.
So on the 12th, in response to his question, I sent a text explaining that I was not trying to get anybody in trouble and that the members are showing concern. So again, I'm functioning or acting as president in my vice president, you know, duties. So when I sent him the text showing him that or explaining to him that I'm not trying to get anybody in trouble and that the members are showing concern. So I was only trying to confirm that no member negligence was taken.
Right. Right. So you were functioning as president, and you obviously have also continued to do your vice president duties. But in this instance, you were functioning as president. Okay. I want to be real clear because you said you're doing vice president duties, and we're going to make sure that everybody understands this 100%. And brothers and sisters, listen to this. I hope you really pay attention to this timeline. If you need it so that you can look at it and understand it, I'm sure that Vice President Jennifer Evans will get it to you. This is something that's absolutely upsetting when you look at it and understand it fully. So what happened next? So you gave
the same day.
Yeah.
Yep, I gave him the information that he requested.
At what time?
Explaining this was not at 8:58 a.m. So,
okay.
Again, explaining this was not to get anybody in trouble. I'm answering your question.
So there's another...
The same day...
I just want to make sure that everybody understands. There's another PRB case out there. I don't want to lose you. Hang in here. Hang in with us because there's a PRB case, Conley versus Worley, that says if you do not have malice intentions, a malicious intention, you are not guilty of conduct unbecoming under that measure from 1963, long time ago. But there's another newer one from 1999 that we'll get into in a little bit. So this thing that she said is no members were going to be in trouble. That is the absence of malice. So that means that under the Worley, Conley versus Worley test, that is not conduct unbecoming. And we need to emphasize these so you understand, members, why she's asking you to come to the meeting on Sunday at 11 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So continue on the next element there. So you gave this to him, and then what happened?
So the same day at 12:23.
You just didn't give it to him. You responded his request. Okay. All right. I want to make sure. All right. Okay. So he has it now.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
The same day, before he even responded to me answering what my question was, you know, are they on the clock? He forwarded the information to a bargaining rep, we'll put it that way, interfering with the administration union and the political foes, I guess, for the information before answering my request even.
So he gave this to your he interfered with the administration of the union and gave this your request information and his coerced response from you.
Mm-hmm.
He gave that to your political foes in the local union.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, is that an Unfair Labor Act as well? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
158A2, if you're keeping track. 158A2. Coercion is 158A1. That's Title 29 U.S. Code, 158A1, coercion, et cetera, and A2, not interfering with the administration or union. And that both are the A1 refers back to Section 7 that we talked about, the protected and concerted activity in the interest of the 1,200 members and also the four, but more for the 1,200 that are demanding some sort of attention to this behavior that brought reproach upon the union. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So he gave it to them, all right? And that's, wow. So the next thing that happened, what happened? That bargaining rep?
From that point, the bargaining rep, forwarded it to the president the next day at 11:14 upon his return.
What next day? You got to be specific.
July 13th at 11:14, he forwarded it to the president upon his return.
So this is being spread all around the union before you get your answer.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. Okay, all right. Just so they can make you look bad, then, huh? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What
at this point,
next?
I still had no idea that anything was going on, anything was wrong. No one was mad.
Because you thought she had a confidential request going into management for time and attendance.
In the bottom of the email, it even states this is confidential.
Oh, so the management broke his own confidentiality in the email that he had.
Mm-hmm.
So anything back and forth is supposed to be confidential. Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he broke that. He violated his own confidentiality agreement. Okay. So the next thing that happened, this is even the next day on July 14th?
Yep.
Give us time.
July 14th at 12:34. I finally got confirmation that nobody was on the clock or unapproved off the clock, you know.
Okay. Unapproved off the clock. Okay. So that took from the time you requested it on July 11, right? July 11?
Mm-hmm. 3 days later.
Okay, 3 days later.
I finally got confirmation. 14th,
he got confirmation after he gave it to everybody, or at least one person who has then been spreading it around the union. And this is supposed to be a confidential investigation that none of management's business, right?
Mm-hmm.
No wonder the bargaining units can't get anything done. You know, no wonder.
Yeah, they pit members against members.
Right. You know, the union or the management and the union seem to be doing a pretty good job of it themselves. And there's also language about unfair labor practice by a union. You can look that up. It's 158B1 and 2, the same title, 29 U.S. Code 158B1 and 2. So we're not going to get into that. Because we're focusing on what management did and how egregious that was and how it's affected your entire life for a year now, almost 11 months, another day, 2 days would be 11 months. So we've gone over the unfair labor practices by an employer, so we don't need to get into that. I believe we've covered the oaths that everybody has to not bring reproach and the earnest, do the duties of the respected offices with guided by an earnest desire to advance the best interest of the international and this local union. The best interest is not dividing members, by the way, or attacking a leader for doing their job.
Mm-hmm.
And then somehow getting it to this level here. That is why you need them at the union meeting. Tell them more about that union meeting. There's a little teaser I put out a while ago. Do you have any more information on that?
So because there were charges filed by the parties, I guess, the investigative parties, I guess, there were charges brought on me, and we have done, an illegal trial, I guess you could say, because the appeal process isn't completed.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the appeal, well, we'll get into a little bit more of that down the road, but there's, if you come to a meeting and you stay at a whole meeting to support this requirement to vote in the vice president's behavior or behalf, you may have the opportunity to get a little extra benefit out of that after the meeting. So let's just leave that teaser out there. We'll keep on teasing. By the way, Article 2, Section 1 says to maintain and protect the interests of the workers under the jurisdiction of this international union. The charter for this local union is under the International Union for 651. That's a wonderful document, and it protects a lot of people. But the president is required to enforce the Constitution to maintain and protect the interests of the workers under this jurisdiction of the International Union. The interest of the workers is that they not be demean when they go in the community, humiliated by behavior of some of their officers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Would you agree? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So we're at right now we are at 55 minutes, and we're going into Section 3. Please remember to consider going to the union meeting Sunday at the 651 Hall, and that's, I believe, on Robert T. and you, most of you know where it's at, just stop over there 11 a.m. in the morning on Sunday and stay a couple hours, and you'll be, you know, doing God's work to make sure that this gets properly corrected. And so, duties, section three, we're 55 minutes. So if you want to come back in or take a break, come back in at the 55-minute mark and you can pick up at section three, the duties of members. Okay, ethical practices. You want to just read those, section one, section five, and then we'll explain the appeal, the trial, Article 31 charge, and then we'll walk the members up the whole process and where it's at on the way up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't you read the ethical practices that seem to apply, one and five.
Okay. Each member shall have the right freely to criticize the policies and personalities of the union officials. However, this does not include the right to undermine the union as an institution, to vilify other members of the union and its elected officials, or to carry on activities with complete disregard of the rights of the other members and the interests of the union.
Okay.
So section one.
Stop there. What, that was section one. Was it your right and duty to enforce the Constitution? And
according to the
yeah.
According to Article 40, yeah.
And you've been vilified and humiliated, and you were just doing your duty, right? And management went in there and started to interfere with the administration of the union. And this isn't anything new, brothers and sisters. This was brought up at trial. I was the trial counsel. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So if you hear me prompting your vice president, I have 54 years doing this and a little more experience regarding the Constitution, et cetera. So no one's perfect, and you have a great, very capable vice president, and this is truly injustice that's been put upon her. So not a good thing, and it violates ethical practices, section one.
Okay. Yep. Each member has the right and responsibility to report activities or practices that they reasonably and in good faith believe are a violation of the ethical practices code.
Oh, my. So you have a right and a responsibility to report activities, but you just don't report them if you don't have all your facts under fact-finding, do you? Right? Because that could get you in trouble, huh? Because you've made possibly a false accusation, because it's like anything else. If you didn't see it, you know, it might not have happened because you just heard something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or hearing it, you know, it's not always a good idea. It's never a good idea, as a matter of fact, to go talk to the parties until you have your facts together. I had a very high-level union officer at the national level tell me that's akin to playing poker, never looking at your hand, bidding your hand, and throwing down and putting money on it, on your poker hand, you know, bidding, you know, betting on it, and not knowing what your cards are, and then throwing them down on the table and losing. Right? Yeah. Yeah, that's what, you know, everybody wants, oh, come to me. You should have just come to me. No, that's not how this works. And there isn't a book out there that says that. In fact, it says not to do that. Other people may have different investigative styles. This one's pretty much by the book from what I'm looking at. So, You have a right and a responsibility, and in good faith and violation of the belief that they are in violation of the ethical practices. I want to see if I have the one where it says they may not do that. They do it without. I thought that said it. It doesn't. I want to look real quick, see if I can find it where it says they may not penalize you for that. Does it? You have the right and duty to practice. I just maybe inputted that, but I mean, look real quick, brothers and sisters, and I'm going to just make sure our ducks are in a row on the ethical practices. So it says, oh, that's the next page has the rest of it. I'm sorry. Page 5. Yeah. Set forth in the ethical practice. An accused member can demonstrate to an impartial committee that the accusation against me are false or politically motivated if that is the case. To an impartial trial committee as ordered by authority, IAB, PRB, impartial trial committee. What that impartial means is that if you have a conflict of interest, for example, you have already voted to sustain charges, you are supposed to excuse yourself. It's called recuse yourself, or recuse. But you just excuse yourself from any trial process. Okay, if you're a sister or a friend of an ex-fiancé, that's close enough that you can't be impartial. You're supposed to excuse yourself from the trial committee. Vice President Jennifer Evans, did anybody excuse or recuse himself from the trial process?
No.
Not a single person?
No. Not a single person, no.
Okay. Did you have to use your exemptions? There's 19 people, and you get 5, and they whittle them down to 9. Each side gets 5. 9, and the trial committee is 7 people plus 2 alternates. Did you have to use all of yours for people that otherwise had a conflict of interest?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
2 members so were on the executive board who have already voted on these charges. The other 3 were officers that are openly talking to the members about, and they're obviously not biased. So that left me with...
Not impartial.
Right.
They are biased. They're not impartial. Okay, right. Right.
Okay. So it left me with 2 members on the trial committee still who had an interest, I guess you would say, in connection to my ex-fiancé.
Okay. They had one was related, sibling, and one was a friend, close friend. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, wow. That's, it goes against the democratic principles of fairness. Okay. Democratic principles mean that you're supposed to be judged by your peers, but they're usually a judge. When the judge hears that, the judge will use an exemption. Pardon me. They'll just say you're excused for cause before the attorneys ever get in there, because they have a whole team of people in a trial selection, the jury selection. That go through.
Yeah,
there
it's the
and
same
say,
thing. If you get, it's the same concept. If you get a jury duty call letter in the mail, you respond with, "I know these people," or
correct.
"I'm somehow connected to this person."
somehow. It doesn't have to be an absolute conflict of interest that's financial. It is any knowledge that they're supposed to. Now, I bring the outside up, brothers and sisters listening, the outside laws, because Article 4, Section 2, I'm doing this off the top of my head, says that we will enforce existing laws and work to repeal unfair labor, laws that are unfair to labor. Says some other things in there, but those are the two things that we're supposed to be doing. Enforce existing laws. An existing law is also outlined in the trial selection for juries in the outside law. And it's the same thing that we should be applying here. There's actually been, and you've suggested, Jennifer, that the trials shouldn't be in any way the same local that I'd be picked from the region itself for fairness.
From the local.
So, yeah, from different locals in the region, not from the local that's party to this, so that's not done. So we're also going to talk about running how the appeal process goes up and comes back down. Now we're at the we're at 96 now, I guess. No, 66. We're at 66. We start at 9. 66 minutes. So we're just about an hour, a little over an hour. But we're going to continue with this. We're going to tell you how the process is, and then we're going to get into the trial, rush to judgment, in Section 4. But right now we're at 66 minutes. If you want to come back and listen to the appeal process, the charging process and the appeals, you may do so at 66 minutes, 67 minutes. So we're going to start, and I pretty much have this on the top of my head, so we're going to roll through this pretty good. Well, charges under Article 31 must meet what's called form and function. Okay? They must be specific in nature. They must have either a constitution violation that's usually pretty clear cut, or a charge of conduct unbecoming that has a higher bar of proof required. Okay. And that proof is the burden of the charging party. And so the I go through this in my head with regard to this case, and this floors me on this. So that's the first one, is, and that's Section 1. It must be having the they must have specificity, and they must also have direct and substantial evidence. And the bar for conduct unbecoming is higher. It isn't just a little bit, it's a lot. And it has to be, going through these, you'll hear it. The second one states essentially that charges must be within 60 days, pardon me, and submitted to the recording secretary. Oh, in Article 1, the interpretations, I'm sorry, Section 1, Article 31, Section 1, the interpretations say that the charges must be considered as submitted. So if they are void of anything, that means that knocks them out of the box. Any one of these elements that are not true or makes it improper, that they haven't been complied with, makes them improper. So and you'll hear this incongruity down the road here a little bit in this. And we're not trying to belabor this and be long, but This is a very complex, very deceitful thing that's been done here. And I stop short of saying it's a conspiracy. I stop short of saying that. Right?
I agree.
You determine.
There were a lot of things that were concealed that I had to get a higher authority to even get information about the charges that were on myself.
Right.
I was denied my own information about myself.
Right. We'll get in that in just a minute.
Yeah.
Section 2 says they must be submitted within 60 days to the recording secretary. Again, Section 1 must be specific, must have direct and substantial evidence, and must be considered as submitted as the interpretations in the back of the book require. So then we come to 3, and it says the executive board, this is Section 3, Article 31, Section 3, says that this is where the executive board comes in and does their assessment regarding A through E. Okay. A then references Section 1, and if A is proper or improper, it must be reported out that A is proper or improper. If it is improper, then you don't even need to go to the rest of it. You just stop right there. The charges weren't specific. They didn't have, with it as submitted, direct and substantial evidence. In Article 31, Section 3B, and this is the only place that they can answer. They can't answer if, like, 2 was violated. They actually have to say 3B, as referencing Section 2, is proper or improper. So in the case of B, that's the only authority that they can, the IEB president or IEB or the president may answer for under B. Can't just say they're untimely under 2, because that's incorrect. So then you have Article 31, Section 3C, and that's does the charges of Constitution violation or conduct unbecoming violation sustain a charge of conduct sustain a charge? Okay, so again, it's pretty clear if the Constitution has been violated, like, you know, did you bring a reproach to the Union? You know, kind of clear if you've been beating somebody up that you did, right? Brought reproach.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't, then, you know, then you just say, hey, that wasn't me. You know, wasn't me. There's a song about that, remember? That's with the Constitution. Conduct unbecoming, we covered Comey versus Worley, and that one says you have to have malicious intent. There was no malicious intent here, as you've heard. The other one is Henderson versus 659, PRB 1257, as I recall. It's in the bound book, and you have to ask them to get it for you, the PRB, if you want to read it. We do have a copy. We just haven't made it public because there's really no place to put it because these are big documents. So, but if you know, if you really want one, I'm sure that the Vice President, Jennifer Evans, would get that and send it to you in a PDF. But that second test of conduct unbecoming is pretty clear. Either you respond to management question, interrogation question, if you respond to an interrogation question by management, did Please give me more information. Then that is not conduct unbecoming. And as you heard earlier, as I said, we'd cover it a little later, that's not conduct unbecoming when you respond to a question by management that Vice President Jennifer Evans did. The other test is if you volunteer information to management without being asked, that is conduct unbecoming, as was the case in Henderson versus 659. We'll get into that a little further down this section, this show here, this podcast. So is that your understanding, Vice President Jennifer Evans?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you just can't go offer information.
Right. That's a violation. But if management asks you, okay, and you didn't give it with malicious intent, as, you know, others seem to have done, they've had malicious intent over here, giving it all around to the union, that's malicious intent. But, you know, oh my, maybe other people were doing some of this, you know, should have been charged with stuff. Well, they had 60 days, as the president said. So the notion that 3C must sustain a charge of the Constitution or conduct unbecoming. Now, you've heard the second element, the prevailing cases of conduct unbecoming. And you just now found out that she responded, not volunteered information to management, and was coerced. And then management, and by virtually asking for that, but then surely giving it to her political foes, okay, in this union, in the union, the 651 local union, is conduct or is Unfair Labor Act by management. So the next one is D, whether it should be at the national or the local. And typically, it's if bylaws, if it's a violation of bylaws, it just gets kicked back as improper for these Article 31 charges. And the next one, 3E, states that you must have a statement from an corroborating witness. You must have one corroborating witness that has direct and substantial evidence that, if not rebutted, then the charge, and this is a conflict in the Constitution, by the way, if it's not rebutted at the 3E, then it would be a proper charge. Now, and again, any one of those that are improper would knock it out, just one. The rebuttal, they're not supposed to give your charges until after, but they're still supposed to give them to you after they decided in 3E, okay, after they considered A through 3E, through A, 3A through E, okay. So I don't want to lose you folks. Stay with us because I know sometimes it's getting late here and I might have to correct myself a couple times. So, but those are the elements that need to be checked. In this instance, it's been found recently that the elements of Article 31, Section 3A, B, and C were the votes voted and said that the charges were improper the way the votes were recorded on the official record by the recording secretary. And the recording secretary keeps official minutes. No tape can be used for the executive board in the membership minutes. Now, you know, she might use it, or a recording secretary may use a tape to refresh their memory when they're crafting the minutes, but as you go back, you may not use them to correct the minutes. They're official once you present them and they vote on them. They're done. They're official. And these have been official for some time. Okay. So we know that those were found to be improper and that should never progress beyond that point. Another reason why you ought to come to the meeting on Sunday at 11 a.m. It'd be a long meeting, but there's some goodies at the end, you know. And not those bad goodies get high goodies. This is just regular goodies. I got to clarify because I'm old school. You know, I know I might say the wrong thing here, mean something different. So I have to clarify. And I said we'd have some humor at the first of the show, didn't I? Come on, guys. Okay. Lord. So she was never offered to rebut under 3E. That's the beginning of what's called due process that's protected by the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution and the 14th Amendment. Due process is protected. And that it was the element that started this, the due process. And they really are supposed to bring the charged party in under Section 3E, tell the person who what's been done here, what's been ruled on, and then they have an opportunity to rebut it before the local union makes their final decision. So, but that's not done, and I've done a lot of these, and it's just simply not done because the local unions don't understand it, and it's in conflict with Section 4, the next section, that says you must receive your charges if you're the charged party within, what, 7 days, Jennifer? Okay.
After their deliberation, yes.
Right. Did you get your charges?
No.
No. So you had to make your first appeal in the blind, right? So the first appeal goes to
the international.
Right. Mm-hmm. So you didn't even know what the charges were.
Didn't know. It was literally a blind appeal.
A blind appeal. I mean, how do you do that? And
how do you appeal something that you don't know what is being said or you're being accused of?
Right. And why didn't the IEB knock this out at that point? They haven't been given her the charges. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what was their decision, IEB?
Because it was a blind appeal, I had no argument, but they did deem or, you know, instruct the local union to give me my charges.
And you received those, you received their decision, what, November 24, something like that, and then you received the actual charges from the local union on December 6th. December 6th, I believe. And then you began an appeal after they decided that the charges are proper.
Mm-hmm.
And no culpability. In other words, you may not find guilt or innocence based on the decision of the IEB or the PRB. So it went up to the PRB, and then what happened? There were, you made an appeal to the Public Review Board, and were there a number of extensions by the International Union to rebut you, and then that took some time, and another couple of extensions on your own part took some time to rebut their, and that was just on the first rebuttal. And then you had the opportunity to then, that was the IEB rebuttal to your charges, or your appeal, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get a chance to rebut what they say, and there's
extensions allowed on both sides there, and everybody was using the extensions because it was election time, and everybody, you know, wanted to make sure that they were going to be decided by the winner, whoever that was. Okay. So then the PRP...
International election, not local. Let's clarify that.
Right. That was international election. Yeah. So then the PRB gets them. And they also ignore that second sentence that asks you for additional information, to which you responded. Mm-hmm. And that makes it conduct that is not unbecoming, because you responded. Mm-hmm. You didn't volunteer. And the first question to management was well within your bounds of doing fact find. So, wow. So then they have their appeal, and your appeal, and they get it, and they rule on it. And that ruling is very concerning. As I was running for international president and worked on that for a year or so, from 2017 on into the convention of June 18, 2018. I ran in 14, but I had some money. Sudden last minute health issues that I really shouldn't be trying to walk with all those tubes suddenly sticking out of me. And that's questionable in and of itself, but there's some more questionable stuff. At least, you know, three people said they would nominate me, and that was sort of public. Jeff Brown was on the radio show, and he said it out loud in 17. He was going to run for governor to nominate me, and I, you know, that was kind of nice of him. Next thing you know, him and his team at his local lost their membership. Now, there's a reason for me bringing this up. That trial was held under the old rules, and PRB 1772, I wrote most of the defense, well, all the defense, essentially, some 300, there was total 400-some pages, but I wrote some 300. For them, and the PRB had a hearing and admonished the International Union, who's running this place, this union, because it's a disaster. They ruled two things. One, the IEB has the tools in Article 31. Section 3, to prevent political and personal differences, as is in this case. And we've made that case in the trial and throughout the appeals. The other thing they said is no trial will ever start before the absolute final exhaustion of the appeal process.
Mm-hmm.
The appeal process was delivered, the last appeal process, request for reconsideration for cause, for false statements or material facts and errant conclusions, to include that they ignored that second sentence that turned that into a question that she responded. Okay, so... this PRB decision overturned those. They went in and abrogated A through E to where you wouldn't even recognize the strict letter, like letter enforcement. As a recording secretary for three terms, I witnessed such strict black letter enforcement a number of times. And as I've helped others, I've watched it also in appeals to the PRB. And And so they stripped that away, and now they're having an appeal before the process, the appeal process is fully complete in violation of their rules of procedures. I think it's Article 32, Section 6, that they derive that authority of the UAW Constitution. But Rule 11 says that you still have the right for a request for reconsideration, and that then will exhaust your appeal process. Nonetheless, they ordered a trial, and in this, obviously in the trial, they also said that culpability, innocence, or guilt may not be determined based on their decision or the IAB's decision, roughly. So there we have it. That's where we were on trial. Now we're going to go give you another section break right here. We're going to go into Section 4, and we're at the 91-minute mark. Okay? So if you want to take a break, because it's been long, take your break. Come back in an hour or so and finish listening to this for Jennifer. Remember, what are they supposed to do Sunday, Jennifer?
Union meeting at 11 o'clock.
Okay. Somebody's getting
a little
tired.
Be prepared for a two-hour meeting.
Right. And some goodies.
Prepared for a two-hour meeting.
And some goodies, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. So Section 4 at the 91-minute mark. I mean, 92 now. I get it right. Yeah, 92 minutes. We're going to start rush to judgment. Again, no trial shall commence. And that language is no trial shall commence, shall be held until the accused and the accuser have exhausted their rights to appeal under Article 33, Section 3D and, and 3F. We've already spoken about the Henderson versus 659, so we could get through this pretty slick here. Is the prevailing test for conduct unbecoming? Again, if you respond to management, it is not unbecoming. If you volunteer information to management, it is conduct unbecoming. This was ignored in trial. We made this case over and over and made this point over and over, and it was abstractly ignored. All they could hear was she shouldn't have went to management without the benefit of everything that we said, that we have already said here in this podcast. So, Jennifer, why don't you take that proper notice thing, because you're way ahead of that than I am.
The proper notice?
Yep.
Okay, so Article 31, Section 7 says that the accused member shall be tried by a trial committee selected by the drawing of names from the members attending the first local union or amalgamated local, which is held at least 5 days after the notification that the member is charged.
Okay, what does that really mean?
So after you get your letter in the mail with your date, you have to give a five-day notice so that you can prepare for trial.
Right.
In this case, we held our normal membership meeting. I was not given the five-day notice, improper notice, so we held a special membership meeting, to give notice, I'm guessing, which at that time, the date was set, but we were told in the meeting two different days because it fell on a holiday weekend. So the members weren't happy about it. We ultimately just accepted it. But I later got a letter in the mail 3 days before the date with only one meeting in a different time change.
Okay. So if you don't mind, let me just reiterate what you just said. Okay. At the meeting, May 7, regular membership meeting, that meeting was supposed to be the notice for the trial selection committee to be picked. Mm-hmm. Okay. And mm-hmm. they decided they were going to have a split meeting, two meetings, on Saturday, May 13. Okay. They did not give a time certain. So the meeting notice at membership meeting was incomplete, and therefore, no, it didn't exist because it wasn't a proper mm-hmm. notice. You may get a proper mm-hmm. notice at meeting, absolutely, because that's where the membership decide that. After the meeting, while for example, the president is exclusive to enforcing the Constitution, the recording secretary is exclusive to sending communications regarding notice they receive in the mail. In this case, notice from the public review board comes in, and either it's the meeting is set at the membership meeting, and I believe they were trying to have one and at on the 7th, and notice was not proper. So they tried mm-hmm. to set
the meeting was called out of order.
Mother's Day. Yeah, and they were going to have that, but they didn't have the times for either one of those, so that was not complete notice, so that's not there. And then the recording secretary is supposed to make any and all other communication. The president on Monday the 8th sent a letter of notice improperly because it's a recording secretary's job. And she understands because she's been notified that Vice President Jennifer Evans is going to have a request for reconsideration, and the appeal process has not been complete. So she is not sending out anything. And to her credit, she's actually, I don't know if she refused or not, but she didn't do this. And the president sent it out on Monday the 8th. It was received on, what would that be, Wednesday the 10th, a couple days later. Okay, received, and then it requires 5 days so you can prepare for the trial committee selection at the special meeting, in this case, a special meeting. Mm-hmm. And Wednesday to Saturday is 3 days, okay? The 10th, 11th, and 12th is 3 days, and then you got the 13th is the fourth day. So you didn't have your 5 days, all right? So it's 10 to 14, 10 to, I'm sorry, the 13th. The meeting was on the 13th, so you received it on mm-hmm. 10th. Okay, it's 3 days to the 13th, I'm sorry, and that notice was improper because 5 days didn't occur. So no trial selection should have occurred. This was brought to the attention of regional director and some others in writing, and they did not correct this because there seems to be a rush to judgment. They don't like Jennifer all that much, evidently. So that notice was incorrect or improper. That shouldn't have been sent by the president, and it wasn't 5 days after receipt. And that's all documented, brothers and sisters. Pardon me. As you might imagine, there's a little cough. Okay, we already covered that selection at the trial selection. No one with a conflict of interest excused himself from being considered or recused him. A conflict having already voted to sustain charges or beholding to the leadership for their appointed office or being a friend or sibling of the Vice President Jennifer Evans' former fiance. So we're going to go into Section 5 now, the trial itself. And okay. I'm going to let Jennifer say some more. And we are at, what's that, 90, it'd be 100 minutes. So we got 120. So let's wrap this up and you can give your little spiel at the end of it. Let's, if you just want to read that quick. Pardon me, I think we got pretty much there. If you just want to read it and get through that rush to judgment, because this trial, we brought all those objections and others to the trial committee chair, and they proceeded regardless of our objections to many of the things that we just talked about here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so once you finish that and just read it all out, and then you can wrap it up, do your closing.
Okay, so the charging party counsel repeatedly stated that the investigation should have been done differently. And their witness stated that it should not have gone to management and that I should have done things differently. And that if they're caught outside the plant while on the clock, it's different. It could be up to a dischargeable offense. When he was asked about the hypothetical question, how he would have handled it, he gave the answer, under oath, mind you, different from the answer that he gave me last year. So he changed his mind, apparently. It went from, I should have went to him so that he could ask the company, to he would have asked the charging parties.
Okay, two brief things. They repeatedly said to look at the IEB, how the IEB mm-hmm. and the PRB decided, violating mm-hmm. the order of the trial by the PRB that said you may not determine culpability, which is guilt or innocence, by their decision. Yet and still they kept...
Those are just arguing whether they fit the criteria. That doesn't mean guilt or non-guilt.
Right. They relied on that in violation of the order. Okay. So mm-hmm. the other thing is, yes, he did offer that, but he said he should have went to management. Well, as we've indicated earlier, in the duties of the president, enforcing the Constitution are exclusive to the president and only to be done by the president to enforce the Constitution. And the bargaining committee does not have responsibilities to enforce the Constitution, only the contract, grievances, and negotiations. That's their duty
mm-hmm.
inside the plant.
Mm-hmm.
All
mm-hmm.
of this was outside the plant. As this person, mm-hmm. Their witness said, oh, it's, you know, anything inside the four walls. None of this was inside the four walls. By his own definition, it wasn't his job. And by the
mm-hmm.
Constitution definition, it was not his job. Yet and still, he continued to say, this is how I would work.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my. So, okay, continue. I'm just clarifying a couple things here.
Okay, so in cross-examining, their witness tried to make the labor, I guess, the email, their question, he tried to make it a statement instead of a question. And then, so we argued that fact, you know, that there is a question mark on the end of that. So obviously that this is making this a question. And then we asked them, do all committee bodies have the same style of investigation method? He, you know, admitted no. And then he explained that his duties are not enforcing the Constitution. But he didn't explain that. He, admitted that, yeah, he admitted that they're not to enforce the Constitution. He also admitted that he doesn't fully understand the Constitution.
Correct. Regarding his duties.
Mm-hmm. He's, you know, his specialty is the bargaining unit, not the Constitution.
That's as the Constitution says. I'm not sure what specialty he has, actually, but because he didn't attest to that, and I shouldn't comment on that, really. So the he was actually very intent on changing that question to a statement to include when he was told that there was a question mark at the end of it, that it was, just a statement by management. Because it indeed changes the entire conduct and becoming under the rules. And when then he was asked, did management ask her for additional information? And he had to say yes. So it was a request for additional information to which she responded, even by his own effing definition of the statement that he's trying to place in there. And that was either somebody's got a problem with the King's English or that was political in nature beyond a pale. So I'm not sure which that is, quite frankly. So continue. The charge party made all of the arguments above that we've already talked about, and then we brought our own witnesses. You want to talk about that?
When we bring our witness of the public report 1257 benchmark case, we bring him in so that he could explain
the charging party.
What exactly is charging, unbecoming, and what the difference is between giving somebody and answering the question, to which he responded, if you give management information on your own, you know, that is unbecoming. If you answer a question, that is not.
Right. And that was the charging party in the Henderson versus 659, Brother Henderson came in, the author of the charges, and gave that clarification that the PRB and how the PRB ruled and how we are to consider his benchmark case. So, okay, and then we have another.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say they tried to get the witness, Henderson, to answer hypothetical questions that he doesn't know anything about the case. You know, how would he have handled it? And just irrelevant, you know, hypothetical questions.
Right. They wanted Henderson to respond to the facts in this case, and he was brought in as a subject matter expert on the matter of his own trial and the decision in his own, or not his own trial, but on his own case, PRB 1257, and on how the PRB indeed ruled, to just bolster that a little. It's like bringing in a brain surgeon to talk about the, you know, what the damage to the brain is, and he has no idea what the fact base is for the accident that happened 11 months ago. Okay? You know, this is somebody that was an expert, just like a brain surgeon for some other stuff. I mean, he's not a brain surgeon. He's a Brother Union auto worker. And, you know, but he's a subject matter expert. He was not brought in for any purposes because he has no firsthand knowledge. It would only be third-hand. And he said, I have no ability to do this. And the trial chair demeaned me and saying, why isn't he prepped on this? Because he's a subject matter expert on the matter of conduct unbecoming or not. So they released him.
They missed the mark on that.
They missed the mark, exactly. They just didn't understand. Because the King's English is really tough for some folk, but, you know, whatever. And the cross-exam, yeah, that's what they you know, and he wouldn't do that. Our next witness, go ahead and talk about that. That was interesting.
So our next witness, he verified the numerous calls that I was receiving because we were working, you know, doing landscaping at the hall. And he was witness to my conversation with the financial secretary. She's not in agreement, I guess, with her, what she responded to me, we'll just say that. But she does acknowledge that there was a conversation that was had. So there was no...
And that she had concerns that they may have been on the
mm-hmm.
clock. That was mm-hmm. her recollection, recent recollection. And we stipulated
mm-hmm.
to that without going into the previous written response, a written record that was nearer the actual conversation. So the
mm-hmm.
idea that there was a question about were they on the clock was not disputed by the financial secretary because she said that
mm-hmm.
in her document. Okay, so
mm-hmm.
That was Facebook post. That was not under oath, by the way. So just for
mm-hmm.
the record. And then in cross-examined, that witness of the second witness that you had,
mm-hmm.
Talk about
mm-hmm.
that, and then we'll get the closing remarks and get out.
So they questioned whether him and I were in a relationship or what his interest in me was, pretty much trying to discredit him. Why are you here? You know, and asked him if he was a racist.
Yeah, that was pretty wild. We objected to that, and
mm-hmm.
of course, you know, it had already been said, so the jury pool there, the trial committee had already heard it. And then we went through
mm-hmm.
closing remarks, and we both sides reflected all of the above. We continued to use the word that functioning President Jennifer Evans offered management information. I objected to that, saying that we proved that she didn't offer, rather responded and gave management information. She didn't offer anything. That's the crux
mm-hmm.
of the issue here. Besides all the other violations in all of this, the whole matter is that there was no malicious intent, and the issue of responding to management was what the Vice President, Jennifer Evans, did. She did not offer anything. So on that, she needs some help Sunday, because the trial committee report will be on the agenda at the bottom of the agenda, I understand. So that
mm-hmm.
can be overturned by the members. And she's asking
mm-hmm.
for the membership who believe in justice, not just us, as there's a few people just trying to feather their own political bed here. Few people, actually. So she's asking for you to please come and help to exact essential justice in this issue. Now I'll let her make her plea. Again, to wrap up that trial, both sides made their closing remarks, and they echoed exactly what was said. And there's another, I mean, I have a lengthy four-page summary. So this was like, you know, one pager here. So you just got the brief version may not be 100% to the letter of whatever A or T or I, but it is a true recollection of what occurred. And to the best of our ability. But the other one is that I wrote up right after is a true representation, exact for the entire thing. We're not allowed to have recording devices, but I am pretty good at all that. We have 5 minutes. You have 5 minutes to tell everybody what's going on Sunday and why they should be there in your own words and what's going to happen afterward.
Okay. So at Sunday's meeting, we will obviously go over the regular membership meeting, the regular order of agenda. But we will also be the trial committee report will be reported out. At that point, you know, either the members are going to be there to either support or object to them. With that, I just want to say that there's been a breach in the confidentiality. The time and attendance should have been left no further than Brian and Mike. Well, I shouldn't say his name. Then labor and my conversation. Management absolutely interfered. They had no business interfering, asking any other questions. My rights were violated. I asked for a grievance, could not get a grievance. To this day, it's on the record, could not get a grievance, still don't have one. Our leaders jumped on with management with illegally sharing the information. So there is an absolute need for solidarity to avoid the divisiveness and the purpose to purposely create the management and the union. And we're falling short to management's trap to divide the local.
Right. Really sad. It's very sad that management shared that information. First, they should be.
Our leadership team is fighting each other harder than we're fighting management at this point.
Correct. So your request for a grievance was for against management for even asking for this additional information, but most assuredly for sharing it with some political opposition of yours, political foes of yours. So that grievance was never written. And it was essentially, while you may not have said it as it's stated in federal law, it was essentially a grievance for management, unfair labor practice by management, interfering with the union and violating your protected and concerted activity. And the union failed to do that. So, okay, you got about a minute. What do you want to say? Tell them good stuff. Tell them about your party.
Come to the meeting Sunday. If you stay all 2 hours, we are going to be having some burgers and beer at what do you know? The charging part. Well, I'll refrain. At Opus, I'll refrain. We will be, gathering in unity. And whether this turns out, however it turns out, we're going to get through this and get past it. And hopefully, we can stand together united afterwards.
There you go. Well, thank you for coming on this and sharing everything that's happened, pretty much everything that's happened. So the members now have a good reason and a really good understanding that's occurred, and you can hopefully count on their support at the union meeting on Sunday to get essential justice and overturn the trial committee's decision. Thank you, everybody, for coming. We appreciate all you. Go ahead. Say good night.
Good night, guys. Thank you for having me, Leroy.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right, having a good night.
Good night. All right, we're done. So we'll just show up.